You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. New York Times bestselling author Laura Thompson returns to the show this week. She's the author of several great books, including The Six, The Lives of the Mitford Sisters, Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life, A Tale of Two Murders, Guilt, Innocence, and the Execution of Edith Thompson, and her new book, Heiresses, The Lives of the Million Dollar Babies. Laura Thompson, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Such a pleasure to talk to you again, Gary.
You know, I mentioned these three of your books because they're the ones that I have sitting here, the ones that I've read and enjoyed. But you've written a lot of other books, including the Six, The Lives of the Mitford Sisters. And the Mitford Sisters, they make an appearance in Heiresses. And also Agatha Christie makes a little brief cameo as well. So do you think there's a theme that runs through all of your work?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, the Mitfords, they're always, the letters of Nancy Mitford were probably my starting point for this book, to be perfectly honest, because I was actually supposed to be researching something else. And then, as usual, my favourite way of researching is to read Nancy. And these names kept cropping up, like Barbara Hutton, and who, of course, although American, was, you know, spent a lot of time in Europe, and people like Winnaretta Singer, the sewing machine heiress, and her niece Daisy Fellows, who was a European socialite and a kind of friend of Nancy Mitford's, or enemy friend of Nancy Mitford's. So Nancy is always a very good source, I find, because she's so on the money in her judgments. And also, if you put her in, she'll always liven up a page because she's so funny. So she was in a way the way into this book. But I'm interested in the lives of, I don't want to say I'm interested in the lives of women. I'm interested in the lives of anybody, actually. But I suppose female psychology does interest me. I suppose heiresses interest me more than heirs, because throughout history, to be an heiress was a more fraught business than being, you know, it was more difficult to be a woman with money throughout history than to be a man, because women have had historically certain struggles. And in a way, this book is about that. It's about the tension between femaleness and the power that should come with being very, very rich. So I don't know whether there's a theme exactly. It's just, I just write about anything that interests me. And it's quite a diverse range of things, really.
Well, yes. I mean, you've written a great deal about racing, about dog racing and horse racing as well, right?
Well, I love, you know, not dog racing anymore. I'm quite ambivalent about that. And in fact, have two rescue greyhounds as pets now.
Oh, I'd love to.
Oh God, they're badly behaved, but very lovely. Anything that. It's a kind of world. It was a kind of world. It was an English social history in a way, because it was such a big deal in England in the mid 20th century, and horse racing also. It's a world. It's a social, you know, and everybody went, and so you're writing about lots and lots of different things. But yeah, I don't know if there is a theme. Perhaps the theme is England in a weird way, but I don't know. I don't know. It's a really interesting question. Murder interests me, but I suppose it does everybody. And everything.
Well, because I'm thinking about the book, the Tale of Edith Thompson, who was a woman, for our listeners who haven't read your book, and they should read it right now. She was a woman who was executed. She's the last woman executed in England. And if I remember
this. No, she's not the last, Gary. Unfortunately, there were a few after her. She was It's 100 years ago this year, in fact. And it's a kind of cause celebre, and well, nobody should be executed in my view, but hers was particularly heinous, kind of, because she hadn't actually done anything. She was deemed to have incited her lover to kill her husband, but there was no physical evidence against her whatsoever.
And if that, if that had happened to a man, if a man had been walking down the street and another someone had come and murdered his wife, there's no way he would have been executed for it.
No, I think that's probably true. Well, what she'd done, she'd I remember very, very well talking about that to you. It was a very marvelous conversation from my point of view, certainly, because that book is probably the one closest to my heart, because I read about that case when I was in my teens, and I'd always, you know, once you read about it, you don't get it out of your mind, because what she'd done, this woman, she was the sort of woman that arouses prejudice. She was very sexy. She wanted more from life than her kind of lower middle class, very straightened sort of upbringing was giving her. And she found it through a love affair, but that wasn't really what excited her. What excited her was writing to this young man, because he was a merchant sailor. He was never around. So what she could do was express herself through these extraordinary letters that she wrote to him. And they're beautiful. They're beautiful. Today she'd probably be a writer, but of course the letters, which were in some ways sort of saying, "Oh God, I wish my husband was dead, and then I could be with you, my darling," sort of wish fulfillment. But in a court of law, they read very, very badly. They read like direct incitement to murder, and they were what hanged her, no question. These letters that were her bid for mental freedom, if you like, ended up ensuring that her freedom was. She was cancelled. In modern parlance, she was cancelled, but cancellation then was total. So it was it's a hell of a story. And I was sort of honoured to write it, and felt a big responsibility writing that book. And it was wonderful to talk about it to you. It really meant a lot, that conversation.
Oh, me too, thank you. But well, when you mentioned cancelled in the modern parlance, as you say, that's one of the things I really love about your work and about Eris is that you're writing about a time, but you're writing about it now. So you often reflect on how it would be in the time of Twitter or whatever, which I really appreciate. I have to say that when I first started to read Eris's, I didn't get very far. I got to like page 4, because on page 4, you mentioned Endless Night by Agatha Christie. And of course, your book on Agatha Christie is so great. And so, and I love Agatha Christie anyway, but I said, wait a minute, she's mentioning an Agatha Christie book that I don't know, I haven't read. So I had to sit your book.
Oh my
back.
God, are you kidding me? You haven't read Endless Night.
I have. So I put your book down. I read Endless Night, and then I resumed. Page 5.
Could you believe Endless Night? Can you believe how good Endless Night is?
Very good. And it's similar to Death on the Nile. So now I want to ask you about if you've seen the recent film of Death on the Nile, and if you have, what you thought of it.
I haven't seen it. Oh. Is that bad?
No, I don't know, because, you know, this is the second of Kenneth Branagh's Poirot films. Did you see the other one that was a remake of Murder on the Orient Express? The two that he's done are two that have already been done, which is odd.
It is odd, actually. I'm sure he knows what he's doing. He definitely knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
But the original films are so good, I think. I mean, I think the film of Murder on the Orient Express is a masterpiece.
I agree. You know, it's so great.
Yeah. And I also really like the Death on the Nile film. So I sort of thought, I don't know, maybe when they come on, maybe if I'm on a plane, that's when I usually watch
them. I don't know. I know you, I mean, So you've written about Agatha Christie and you wrote hundreds of pages about her, but you still come back to her. Is it still something that you think about? Oh, I should read another Agatha Christie today.
I think she's so wise. I really, more and more, and I just had a piece about her in an English newspaper today, actually, because I just think it's a line I've used before when I say her plots are unrealistic. I mean, the plot of Death on the Nile is incredibly unrealistic, but everything about it is true. Everything about it is true. All those people are acting in what I would consider to be a truthful way. I think her real gift is for the piercing of motivation, if you like. And her motivations are so true. And I think Endless Night, which is, you know, she was 76 when she wrote that book. 76, wow. Very posh. You know, brought up in Edwardian, upper middle class England. And if you listen to her voice, it's unbelievable. You know, she's so, so really, really, really posh, like the queen, pretty much. And yet she gets under the skin of this young man, this working class young man in 60s London, you know, young man on the make, young man with a sense of absolute entitlement. A very, very, very modern creation. And, you know, there might be one or two wrong notes in her, but I think she absolutely gets this guy. And he marries an heiress. He marries an heiress. And that's why the book, because I know her, I sort of almost know them by heart, I think, whether that's a good thing, I don't know. And I do. She naturally comes into my mind the same way that Nancy Mitford does. And I thought, oh, gosh. Psychology of the heiress in that book, Ellie, is so good because Ellie is so rich, she doesn't even think about being rich. And I think that I kept returning to that with heiresses. What if I suddenly got millions of pounds? That would be really great because I don't have millions of pounds now. They've always had millions of pounds. What does that feel like? What does it feel like when money has no context? No sense of what's gone to earn it, no sense of what it's like not to need it. And there's a really, really good portrait of that mentality in Endless Night, I think, when she goes and buys, and she could go and have a 5-course lunch at the Ritz, so she doesn't. She goes and buys a little baguette and blah, blah, blah. That's a silly little example, but it's absolutely accurate, I think. I think everything that Christie writes has got that cleaving to the heart of the truth of a person and what it's like for this young man who marries this heiress and how conflicted he is about it. And so it just seemed like a good, I mean, I also reference people like Henry James and Edith Wharton and Ben Austin, because they're all really written on,
yes.
They're, you know, absolutely brilliant on money and what it's like. But it's quite fun to reference Agatha, I think.
Well, when you reference those other literary works, I think, oh, I really haven't done enough reading. But at the same time, I know that I can't I know that I can't read a Jane Austen novel in a day, and I know that I can read an Agatha Christie novel in a day or two. So I went for the Agatha.
Absolutely. There's a film of Endless Night, which she really hated. She really hated that film. But it's quite good, actually. She was just, she was, you know, she wasn't really a screen lady. She was a person of the theatre, and I think she always felt the screen didn't do her book justice, really. Other than Billy Wilder's Witness for the Prosecution, she liked that. But that's a very theatrical film. But she didn't like the film of Endless Night. But you might like it. I think it's good.
Well, I recently had Hayley Mills on the show. And,
oh, no way. Really?
Yeah.
And oh, how lovely.
We talked a little bit about it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I must hear that. That's right.
Hi, I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we're getting back now to our conversation with New York Times bestselling author Laura Thompson. Her books include The Six, The Lives of the Mitford Sisters. Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life. A Tale of Two Murders, Guilt, Innocence, and the Execution of Edith Thompson. And her newest book, Heiresses, The Lives of the Million Dollar Babies.
And so I think Endless Night was a great kind of foreword to your book because it set up what it was like to be an heiress. And like you're saying, you know, if you think about, oh, if I had that money, when you hear about people who have a lot of money and things don't go well for them, you think, well, if I had that money, things would be a lot better for me. I wouldn't squander it or blow it or whatever the way those people did. But what's really interesting in your book is the whole concept of what it means to be an heiress as opposed to an heir, because it sets you up basically as prey.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it, I mean, in a way, the book splits into two, because I didn't want it to be facile. I didn't want it to be a description of yachts or, you know, jewels or all those things. There's only so much you can write about that stuff. And so what I did, I took it back. And it kind of begins in the 17th century with a girl called Mary Davis who inherited by sheer luck. She was a great niece and she inherited this sort of chunk of marshland, which is now Mayfair and Belgravia. It's now the most expensive real estate in this country. Hmm. But it was just marshland. And so she was married off aged 12, sold off for £9,000. She had no identity except those acres. She had no identity except that land. And her life took a very, very poor turn because of it. So I was very interested in these heiresses who, the book sort of up to the late 19th century. I mean, the book is about, it's a lot about Britain and a bit about Europe and quite a lot about America. But the early part is really about Britain. And it's up to the late 19th century when there was a law that came in called the Married Women's Property Act. Well, there were two. And so by 1882, if you got married, you could keep what was yours. Up to that point, it became his. A wife had no identity in law. You were one identity, and that was him, basically, once you got married. So I wanted to write about that and about the fact that being a woman and having money, you were almost better off not having it, which is a crazy thing to say, but in a weird way, you have more agency. What should have brought power, what should have brought strength, made you totally vulnerable, unless you were very, very aristocratic, in which case you had a kind of double layer of protection. But a lot of these girls weren't. They'd come by this money by sheer accident, because there weren't any men, all the men had died, whatever. And they were like sitting ducks, just sitting ducks for this kind of almost this passion in heiress snatching, whereby girls could be seized off the street, or girls could be, yeah, kidnapped or date raped or forcibly married by this kind of network of dodgy priests. And because the men knew that once they did that, they were kind of home and dry, usually. It was a capital crime. There were people executed for it. But it was a gambler society, and if you didn't have very much, it was worth the risk. So that early part of the book, which I was sort of researching with my jaw dropping onto the computer. And then you get the second part, where you get a sort of interlude, which is the American heiresses, the dollar princesses who came over to England and were married off to aristocrats, you know, the kind of Julian Fellows, the Julian Fellows chapter, if you like. And then after that, you get the move toward women having more agency, if you like. Because I didn't want it just to be about heiresses. It's really the story of all women, but kind of writ large, if you like. There is a subtext whereby it's the move toward something like gender equality. But I don't mean to hammer that home. It's just that's there.
Well, when you mentioned the Julian Fellowes episode in your book, because I think everybody has watched Downton Abbey and some have watched The Gilded Age, and I have watched them both. And I like them both. And your book illuminates those fictions because, you know, those are very intriguing stories. That whole upstairs downstairs idea of these are people, they're just as much people as the other people, but these people have money and these people don't.
Exactly. Because in a way, the starting point for this book was that cliche of the poor little rich girl, or the other cliche, which is money can't bring happiness, to which my answer would always be, you know, well, can I try and see? I'm not pretending to be, I am a lucky person, I'm a privileged person, but I haven't got a huge amount of money. And, you know, you can't help thinking, gosh, that would be quite nice, wouldn't it? You could have 20 retired greyhounds, and you could have, you know, you could dress at Givenchy, and you could have a house on the Upper East Side, and you start thinking. But these people have just got these things. And they cannot have, through no fault of their own, they can't possibly value them the way that they're not a burst of sunlight on an ordinary life. They are your life. And so having started off thinking, oh, come on, you know, like Barbara Hutton thinking, oh, come on, you know, you've got everything. You're intelligent. You're a very attractive person. You inherited sort of about what was then, so God knows what it would be now, $50 million in 1933. You can attract a man like Cary Grant. What is your problem? You know, there was a part of me that was thinking that. But then you start to think about it. And by the end, I did feel enormous sympathy, because you try and enter the psychology of people who carry what I get. Even by the time that women had more rights in law, there was no reason for them to have this vulnerability, but they still, a lot of them still did have it, because they don't know if they're valued for themselves. No, but they cannot trust anybody to value them for themselves. And that must be quite odd.
Well, you never know.
You never know. And that, of course, is what Henry James does so brilliantly in Washington Square. I mean, that's just the supreme sort of parable of the heiress's burden. So, although some of the women in my book did have a great time, and I'm at pains to say it's not a sort of misery fest.
No, it's an extremely entertaining book. Although there is a lot.
That's nice of you.
There's a good deal of misery, but that misery is not my misery. Therefore, I find it very entertaining.
Well, yes, there is that.
I was fascinated in the early parts of your book about how young a girl can be and still be prey to being kidnapped and married. I mean, she could be just a little kid.
Oh, good Lord. Absolutely. Because a lot of London is actually built on the land that was owned by these girls. Mary Davis, the one I was talking about earlier, she's like the uber heiress.
Yeah.
She was the one who owned what, you know, is now Grosvenor Square and Belgrave Square and all the rest of it. I mean, just incredible, incredible, really. But there was another one who owned a lot of what's now Chelsea, and another one who owned a lot of what's now Marylebone. And, you know, it only needed enough people to die off, and these girls got this. And as I say, if you were aristocratic, like the one who was the Duchess of Portland, she was okay. She was educated. She was like an enlightenment, a creature of the enlightenment. She had what you might call inner resources. But some of them, it was just external resources. And they just couldn't withstand the kind of assaults that were coming, sometimes literally, from people who just wanted what they had. They were nothing except what they had. Mary Davis was being, she had a terrible mother. She was being paraded in Hyde Park in a carriage from the age of about six, you know, like a prize animal being shown off to potential husbands. Because even though the land was just marshland, people knew it was worth something. And, you know, people would put their bids in. And then in the end, the one who got her, Sir Thomas Grosvenor, they became the Dukes of Westminster on her money, on her money. And her life was a very, very, he was okay, but when he died, she was just, she was 35 and she'd never done anything. She'd never known anything. She was just prey in the most literal, like something out of Bram Stoker almost, mm-hmm. You know, carted off to Paris by a priest and forcibly married and date raped. And oh my God, I mean, it's an extraordinary story. And sometimes they were put in asylums so that their families could control the money. And the law wasn't much good.
Now, Laura Thompson, how did you research all of these heiresses from way back hundreds of years ago?
Well, I had a very simple method, which was the Times of London, the Times newspaper, which is our newspaper of record. And they have this extraordinary database going back to 1785. Wow. So my starting point was go on their database, put the word heiress in the search engine, and I got about something like 11,000 hits, and I read them all. I read them all, and it was fascinating. It really, really was fascinating. Sometimes they were just little Miss Blah of Blah, you know, who's worth 50,000 a year, has eloped with a certain Captain Blah, you know, and you thought, gosh, there's probably a tale in there, but that was, you know, you obviously couldn't follow them all up, but some of them leapt out at me, and then some of them would become court cases because families would take on these young scoundrels who'd seize their daughters or what have you. And these court cases, they were like, you know, like it would be today. Every word was reported. All the, you know, every detail was in the papers, columns and columns and columns of this stuff, every word that was said in a courtroom. And so you would just go through it all and pick out anything that seemed, you know, try and distill the essence of it. And I sort of just picked people who I felt advanced the, you know, illustrated a certain point or showed how history was moving on, how things were becoming more enlightened or less enlightened or something like that. Just pick stories that I felt made a wider point or that were peculiarly interesting, because there were so many, and you did have to limit yourself a bit, and you also had to limit that, because I mean, some of them were like Gothic horror, you know, these wives being, their houses would be seized from them, and then they'd be locked up in these houses, and they'd have to get servants to help them to get away, and then, you know, they'd be declared mad, and they had to find someone who would testify in a court that they weren't mad. And it really, you know, some of them would make very, very good films, I think, but they're you know, I had to sort of rein it in, because it would just be, you know, the reader would be like, oh my God, you know, this is too much. relentless horror. And what I also did quite a lot was, you know, literature from the time, which often referenced a lot. I mean, Jane Austen's very good on, you know, young men on the make, trying to get off with rich girls and, you know, all that kind of thing. So you would drop in literary references to illustrate a point. That was quite an interesting thing to do. And then later people like Edith Wharton for the whole Gilded Age and everything. So that was quite fun. All my favorite writers sort of featured.
So you reread a lot of those novels as well?
Yes. God, when I reread Age of Innocence, I thought this is a spectacularly brilliant novel. Superb, superb novel. And Washington Square by Henry James. And, you know, just that was really very pleasurable doing all that. But heiresses they are like a sort of trope. And I couldn't find a single one that had a happy life. Not one.
In literature.
I mean, it may be that one of your listeners will, or some of your listeners will be able to say, you know, there are. But I didn't find one. Even in films, if you think about like the Philadelphia story, and Katharine Hepburn has to be sort of brought down to earth before she, you know, she has to be reminded that she's just an ordinary girl and blah, blah, blah. You know, they're not allowed to win because of money. The money is not allowed. Whereas in real life, of course, if you have money, you kind of do win quite a lot. but the scales have to be weighted so that, you know, the poor girl, like in Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth Bennet is allowed to win out against the rich girl, you know. I don't know how true, I don't know how realistic that is, but some of it was really historically very useful, you know, the social history that's incidental in novels.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSEO, and we are chatting this week with New York Times bestselling author Laura Thompson. Her books include The Six, The Lives of the Mitford Sisters, A Tale of Two Murders, Guilt, Innocence, and the Execution of Edith Thompson, and Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life. Her new book is called Heiresses, The Lives of the Million Dollar Babies.
Well, now you do bring it up to modern times in your book, because you also talk a lot about Patty Hearst. And of course, that seems like modern times to me, because I remember that very well. And I want to get your take on Patty Hearst. Do you think that Patty Hearst? Well, what do you think about Patty Hearst?
Well, I have to be very careful.
Yeah.
Because I researched that assiduously through newspapers, and that was really interesting, seeing the, you know, how it played out at the time. I mean, my feeling was always that she was, you know, held by people who, you know, in a state of terror or in a state of, I don't know. I never found it, you know, looking back on it, I wouldn't find it that difficult to believe that you would go along with people who have the capacity to kill you at any moment, sort of thing. But that comes into the book when I'm sort of talking about heiresses who rebel against their privilege, if you like, because you have a move to gender equality, you also have a move toward a supposedly more equal society. So you do have heiresses who are starting to see that, you know, the system is not entirely as it should be necessarily. So you had an heiress who joined the Irish Republican Army. I wrote about her. And with Patty, the image of her with that automatic is so powerful that you sort of had to address it. But I don't know. What do you think about her?
Well, you know, it's a fascinating story for sure. I mean, she was, like you say, kind of just trying to live a normal life. She was going to school. She was living in not any kind of, she was just living in a normal apartment when she was kidnapped, and she was living with her boyfriend, who had a horrible mustache, I recall. And And then, you know, it was just such a bizarre turn of events. And I guess the thing that was used against her in court was the fact that she had many opportunities to walk away.
Yes, that is a big question. Yeah, when she goes on the run with the,
But you know, when you know the whole story, as you tell it in the book, that, you know, she was basically tortured, or I don't know about brainwashing or how that all works, although I've read a lot of James Bond novels. But I mean, I don't know what I would have done in that situation.
Well, exactly. So I was, I was amazed how hostile some of the reporting, her initial trial. I was amazed. And there was an attorney, or I can't quite remember, a district attorney, who sort of said, it sounds ridiculous to say it, but there is a prejudice against the rich that may be working against this girl, kind of thing. And of course
there is.
Yeah. As soon as you say things like that, inevitably people think, oh, hang on. What about, you know, they're rich. Why should they be, you know, they're the lucky ones, which they are. Although she wasn't even that rich, was she? I mean, the Hearst fortune was divided up in a
there's a lot
ways.
Of it. There's a lot of it.
A lot of it, but quite a lot of people.
I mean, she has enough money that you would never have to think about money.
Yeah. No, sure. Yeah. But I was basically sympathetic to her. But I mean, this is looking at it from the outside. But I just try and portray the facts, and also how she was perceived at the time, and I imagine quite a terrifying image, and what that would have represented in the 1970s to what appeared to be the you know, the social order. That's what interested me, really.
Do you think that this is, you know, because of show business, I guess, people can acquire wealth in a different way than they could in the early period in which you're writing. That is, somebody can come into money either through the entertainment industry or something else, as opposed to inheriting money and titles and all of those things. We don't have titles over here, but... But I think we're still impressed. Oh, he's the Duke of whatever. Do you think it's an era that's over because of the fact that pretty much anybody can, I'm not saying that everybody can, but anybody can become incredibly wealthy?
Well, I do sort of talk about how from, I don't know, 100 years ago or whatever, how the inherited wealth started to sort of become part of the world of celebrity, if you like. You know, whereas the start of the 20th century, certainly in this country, an heiress was regarded, they were like the celebrities, and the big houses actually had red carpets outside them leading, you know, if they had a big party, people would line. You know, I read about some woman, she couldn't get into her own house because the crowd that had gathered to see people turning up for the, you know, the ball and what have you, was as great now as it would be before the Oscars or before a premiere or something. So they were the celebrities. And then you start getting film stars and what have you, and then the world start to mix, you know. I mean, even to the point of Meghan Markle marrying Prince Harry or whatever. I mean, that's a certainly.
She was a TV star, and now she's a royal.
Well, yeah. But I mean, you know, going back, then the worlds did mix, and you would get big house parties at huge country houses, and people, the guests would include the Queen Elizabeth, George VI, Edward VIII, or whatever, and well, obviously not those two simultaneously, And then people like Douglas Fairbanks and people like that, or David Niven. And so you see the, and particularly in this country where an actual aristocrat, unless they have money, it carries no sort of meaning really. You know, people think it does and they talk about the establishment and what have you, but actually the real establishment is not people like that, not at all. You know, it would be more like to be Tony Blair than the Duke of wherever. So that has changed. I end the book, in a way I end the book with the death of Barbara Hutton, because she seems to me she's the person I reference throughout constantly, because she ticks so many heiress boxes. She's, you know, so many of the tropes of the unhappy childhood and the unhappy marriages and the, you know, the various dependencies and all that kind of thing. But you could go on with the book. I mean, I do say the prenup, in a way, ends this story. In a way, it does. But you could equally go on. You could talk about people like Paris Hilton, who are sharp, and they're sort of ironic heiresses in a way. They kind of monetize their own money. And then to return to what you're talking about, you could talk about people like Britney Spears or people who make a huge amount of money when they're very, very young and run into the same sort of problems as I was talking about earlier. But I don't know, I had to find a cutoff point. and also, I just read about a truly terrible case in this country where a very rich woman had drawn up a prenup and then the husband had murdered her because he was so angry that if they divorced, he would only get a very fixed amount of money. So he murdered her to get the lot because the prenup had created its own, you know, barrier to him being an heiress snatcher of the historic kind. So in a way, nothing really changes. Money totally brings out the worst in people. If you're worried about, you know, my book does make you poverty is a terrible evil, but if you've got an enormous amount of money, my book will probably make you feel quite happy about that.
Well, Laura Thompson, here's hoping that you and I both get the opportunity to find out what it would be like for us to have a tremendous amount of money.
Well, now you're talking. I won't turn that one down.
Your new book is called Heiresses, The Lives of the Million Dollar Babies, and it's filled with great stories. We haven't even scratched the surface. There's so many great little stories in it, and congratulations on it. And thank you so much for spending some time with us talking about it on From the Bookshelf.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Gary. Thank you so, so much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.